Welcome to the ENR Critical Path Podcast. Today, we're having a tech talk with Brian Skripak, Director of Virtual Design and Construction at Canon Design. Brian continually drives innovation by focusing on the process of orientation of the building information model enabled VDC process at Canon Design. He has 23 years of experience, with the last 13 focusing on the integration of BIM and VDC to transform project delivery. Brian has successfully developed and managed BIM-enabled delivery systems for large Canon Construction Services efforts. In addition, he focuses on the use of building information models to capture and structure relevant facility data to achieve the value a BIM-enabled VDC process brings to facility owners from an interoperable lifecycle management strategy. A thought leader in his field, he's an advocacy group member and past chair of the AIA National Technology and Architectural Practice Knowledge Community, and serves on the BIM Forum Committee responsible for authoring the LOD specification. Please welcome Brian Skripak.
Thank you.
I'm Jeff Yoders.
And I'm Eileen Cho.
Welcome to an ENR Tech Talk. So, Brian, I met you way back when Ohio State was executing BIM for existing buildings. It was an initiative at OSU where facilities management was using Revit models, and they were sort of in the very beginning of what we today call digital twins, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was, I think that started about 2010. When I was in Columbus, I had the opportunity to work with the university and really start to help them understand how they could really leverage best practices to create models and, you know, start to translate what the difference was between what my firm was building as an architect, what engineers were providing, what contractors were doing, and what trades were doing. And, you know, what we really looked at was, you know, there were design intent models, there were, you know, work intent models, which were the trade models. And we really focused on, you know, understanding what the university could use as a as maintained model that really allowed them to focus in on what they needed to manage that facility across its life cycle. Because ultimately, it's very different than what an architect or a mechanical trade partner would produce.
Yeah, this was really the beginning of BIM project delivery standards, right? I mean, this was, you know, you had a COBE to asset worksheet macro. Defined execution in the LOD matrix. This is where all that started, right?
Yeah. I mean, when we were able to, you know, interview and win that job, we talked about really having this idea of a BIM project delivery standard being focused on two things: how a project's executed and how deliverables are formatted. And that really governed the entire document that was created for them. And it was focused on what the university needed to be successful.
Brian, it says, your bio says that you spent, you know, roughly half at this point of your career focusing on VDC and BIM. When you first started off your career, did you know that it would go in this direction?
No idea. I started off in a traditional, you know, my degrees in architecture, and, you know, it's been quite a while since I practiced in a traditional architectural role.
Do you miss it?
No, it's fun. I love what I do. It's a unique opportunity that I found myself in, and it's been a great way to advance my career and, you know, help lead the industry.
So I guess we should explain to our listeners here about what levels of development are. Brian and I were both involved with the BIM Forum, where they developed something called the LOD spec.
Yeah, the term LOD, as you've just heard, stands for level of development. And I'll benchmark that by saying we're talking about the use of the term LOD here in the United States, using level of development and the BIM Forum and AIA definitions of that word. LOD is a term that probably has a lot of confusion out there in the industry. I think we're getting over that now. But it's not a standard. It's a specification. And I think the best way that we can delineate that is it's really almost a dictionary or an encyclopedia. for how building elements, components, and assemblies can potentially evolve through the project delivery cycle. So what we do with LOD is we look at these benchmarks of LOD 100, which is a generic system, LOD 200, which is still generic, but it has approximate size, shape, quantity of the elements that are being produced. We continue to evolve to LOD 300, which then transitions to a specific component that's specific about its size, shape, orientation, and location within the building. We have LOD 350 that starts to look at anything that would cause interference with other objects. LOD 400 becomes a level that starts to look at installation and fabrication requirements. And these really talk about a broad approach of evolution to components. And once we know by looking at the LOD specification, a wall has these specific criteria as it advances from 100 through 400, we can start to delineate as a model element author and the architect to say, I'm going to produce the walls at, they're going to be at LOD 200 at the end of my design development phase. And by the time I get to the completion of my contract documents, my CD phase, they're going to be at 300. And that's what my design partners, my construction partners, and the building owner, that's the level of development that they can rely upon those building elements for. So it's a really powerful communication language that's been level set across the industry and has that specification with images and graphics that go along to say, this is what LOD 300 means for an interior wall partition. And everybody can agree upon that because it's been documented. And that really becomes powerful and gets us past, you know, a challenge that we'd always had before where somebody would say, oh, we're going to do BIM on a project. Well, what does that mean you're going to do BIM? Mm-hmm. Well, it means I'm going to produce these elements at these levels so they can be relied upon for others to do what they need to do with the model throughout design and construction. And, you know, once we can speak that common language, we can really move forward efficiently.
Yeah, one of the things that I love about the LOD spec is that it really defines, you know, what is in a design and in things that, you know, back in the old times, the pre-CAD times, you know, even in early CAD where a contractor would just fill in the spaces and create what they wanted. Now all of that's detailed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you look at some of the AIA contract language, the G202 document, which is part of their digital data protocol, actually has a table that allows you to put what level of development those assemblies will be built at. And that becomes part of the contract. So it is therefore a contractual obligation that you'll be delivering that information at that said level of development, which creates a good level of accountability for the entire team.
So, Brian, what are some of the risks involved, say, with liability or intellectual property, and how do you address those?
I think one of the best ways to look at risk is, taking on a perception of risk management as opposed to risk avoidance. And I know for Canon Design and working with our legal team, it's always been important that we clearly document what we're going to produce and what it can be relied upon for. And I think that's the power of new contract language that's evolving in the industry. They said the AIA has their E203, the G201, G202 documents that allow you to do this. If you're working with DBIA, they have their BIM exhibit that attaches to their contracts. If you have an AGC contract, there's the 301, the consensus doc 301 document that allows you to be very explicit about what you're providing and what it can be relied upon, reused for, how it can be edited and modified or not. So the more clear that you are in your contract language, that's really the opportunity that you have to manage that risk by clearly stating what can be done.
Brian, you were both a chair and a leadership group member of AIA TAP. Could you explain a bit more how that committee, the Technology and Architectural Practice Committee, really works on these documents and pushes technology into everyday practices?
Yeah, I mean, and I haven't been a part of the AIA technology and practice knowledge community for a little bit, but it's really the AIA Contract Docs Committee and how they collaborate with other groups, such as the AIA Technology and Practice Group. We also saw a lot of collaboration with the project delivery knowledge community and the project management knowledge community, and really getting a holistic perspective from all of those different aspects. These documents, you know, one of the things that excites me about that is these documents just aren't about software. It's really how software is being utilized to have a more efficient process and how we deliver our projects. So that really well-rounded approach of technology, project management, project delivery is really where it all comes together.
To what extent would you say that VDC has permeated the building or construction world, and you know, will it someday be, I don't know, virtually 100%?
It'll probably take a while to get to 100%. I think, you know, certainly any large construction project, and probably even going down to medium construction projects, are all using it. There's always going to be small projects that are out there where it probably isn't something that falls into line with those expectations or isn't being done. But I think the construction industry has seen the value. And I think the more opportunities that they can leverage, they know the better that they'll be able to deliver a project for the owner.
It's going to be hard to get into those retail banks and fast food restaurants. I always say it's not a lot of difficulty in those, you know?
Yeah. But at the same time, though, there's a value of creating a kit of parts to, you know, have a, you know, reusable process. That's valuable as well. And I think where we see, you know, has a fast food restaurant that is really just assimilating the design to the site constraints, then, you know, there's also an opportunity for them to build and see how they can, you know, maintain those facilities later. You know, maybe it's a, you know, a life cycle assessment or a, you know, asset management tool that can still be in place that brings them that next level of usability.
I'm glad you mentioned process, because one of your jobs as VDC leader at Canon Design is to develop model-based delivery processes for prefabricated modular units in healthcare and other projects. Can you tell us more about Canon Design's prefabrication modular efforts?
Yeah, that group is really focused. Our Modular Design Plus team that we have, been fortunate to, you know, see a project that's wrapping up right now that we had done for Los Angeles County and the University of Southern California, which is a rehabilitation village right in LA County. This is a series of, it's a 5-building campus. 4 of the buildings, which are actually the same, we were able to take advantage of and really bring a high level of value to the client in LAC and USC to say, you know, we can help to expedite the construction process by turning in some of these repetitive units into modular prefab components. So what we did was we took a series of different administration offices, toilet rooms, toilet shower rooms, and some of the dormitory style rooms that were there, and were repetitive across those 4 buildings and the multiple stories of each individual building. So we had about 76 units that were prefabricated in Kansas and shipped across to LA County. Those individual units were basically craned up to the floor that they needed to be in, rolled into the site, put down, and abutted up next to new construction and moving forward. We were able to do all of the metal framing, the electrical, plumbing, and mechanical that was internal to that room, and provide the interior layer of gypsum wallboard on those rooms so they could go in and finish out the spaces against the abutting rooms and move forward.
Brian, can I ask you for, like, can you give me a general sense of how much can time and money can be saved off traditional methods using modular, like, you know, 50%, 10%?
Well, I think the big opportunity that we're starting to see, and again, the project that I just mentioned is one that's still under construction. But if we think about it, we have a whole separate unit in another state putting up metal studs, plumbing and providing running electrical conduit and placing boxes in. We're basically doing double duty on those rooms. So while studs and other areas are being laid out, we're basically doubling that time where people are being billable and able to construct those elements. The other opportunity is quality control. We're working indoors on the floor in a temperature controlled space. We don't have trades because it's a large factory and assembly line. We don't have trades stepping on each other's toes and running into each other. So there's a lot of opportunity to take advantage of these multiple work streams that come together out on the job site once everything's complete.
Yeah, a lot of this opportunity really is process opportunity, right? Because we've talked a little earlier about levels of development and now the opportunity to create things in a controlled manufacturing environment. It really is on the construction industry to look at their processes and see, hey, how can we achieve efficiencies versus, you know, doing things the same way?
Yeah, and it was one of the interesting things that, you know, this was the first, you know, modular project that I had worked on. But as we started to look at this project early, you know, really early on in the DD phase and transitioning these rooms to modular, starting to look at what the constraints are. And, you know, by the time the contract documents were done, we had really defined, our prefab team had really defined where all of those systems were. So coordination on those rooms was completely finished. And that's pretty powerful. When you look at the larger scale of the project, that's really just the time when that type of coordination is just beginning. And all those rooms that we had put together and started to look at were done. So that was a big opportunity for process efficiency, like you're talking about, Jeff.
It seems that in addition to really enhancing coordination and collaboration and mutual understanding across the project team, it seems like this is a great opportunity for community outreach and external stakeholders. It's for them to really see what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting once you get to that point. It was a big learning experience too. To have a detailed hands-on conversation about what that construction is going to be and educate the design team on something that they're probably typically not involved in. It also had some unique educational opportunities as far as how do you deal with code reviews. You know, we're in the Midwest creating these units, shipping them out to the West Coast, and you have an AHJ and, you know, code teams that need to go out and look at this information about something that's being fabricated halfway across the country. So there were a lot of new avenues for us to, you know, learn how to work in this way and share those experiences.
Yeah, one thing I've found covering a lot of these modular projects is that the teams don't necessarily break up from project to project. You know, if you've got an electrical contractor and an MEP, both with fab shops, and, you know, they can make you bathroom pods on this project, then, you know, it seems like the contractors are willing to pick them again. The architects are usually involved in several projects. It's not every project isn't a one-off as it was before, where the teams sort of stay together more, right?
Yeah, the more collaboration you have, I mean, I think that's like on any project, whether it's modular or it's a design build project, and you have that team that has learned how to work together effectively and share information and collaborate and communicate. They want to work together again because they know that you basically have a recipe for success. So you start to want to see those teams collaborate more and more. And I think that's also been one of the value points for Canon Design, having a larger integrated services approach where, you know, we're fortunate enough to have architects, interior designers, structural engineers, mechanical, electrical, and plumbing engineers all under one roof, but also have a construction services group where we can serve as a design builder, where we are the contractor and the AE. And that really provides a powerful opportunity to really deliver high quality projects to the clients that we're working with.
You were talking about levels of LUDs and how they're, you know, constantly evolving. Is there a much more evolving to do?
No, I think the benchmarks that are there, the evolution that we need to continue to see is the further refinement of the document. And there's, you know, there's still some holes. I shouldn't say largely, it's a 100% volunteer based group. So, I think we still have some gaps that we need to fill in there. I think one of the other things that we've seen is, we started to see an expansion into more horizontal construction where it was predominantly focused on, you know, buildings and vertical. We're also seeing stuff on roadways and more civil and infrastructure.
Bridges.
So yes. I think that's probably a little bit more of an evolution. And, you know, we might see some things that modular construction starts to push forward. But I think once we look at modular, it's really saying that that modular prefab company starting out at 400, we're jumping right into that. You know, we know where the architect has defined where a wall is. And when our modular plus team, our modular design plus team started working, it was, all right, let's start laying out metal studs. Let's start identifying where, let's coordinate back to the architectural drawings on where, you know, outlets and switches are and where lights are going to be. And so it's just that work starts at a much higher level of development.
Yeah, it's funny because it was really a multidisciplinary approach with everyone involved in the BIM forum contributing.
Yes.
And, you know, level 350 wasn't one that was planned in the beginning. There was, you know, going to be 100, 200, 300, 400. And, well, I guess I'll let you tell it, Brian, but that sort of, that came about as a level that was needed, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was on the nice organized 100, 200, 300, 400. The challenge was that as those definitions came out, which is what the AIA started with, there really seemed to be a gap and a need that became very evident once all of these multidisciplinary groups were working with. As we went from a specific system to one that talked about fabrication, installation, ready information. But in between there was really the sweet spot that we were seeing from the construction industry, which was, well, what do we need for true coordination to occur? And that's where 350 came from. So anything that causes an interference, some of the gaps that we were seeing was, well, we don't need all the fabrication information on ductwork, but sure would be really good to know where all of the hangers are. You know, where is, you know, any information and support that we have there? If you think about structural steel and you have diagonal bracing and there's a huge gusset down in the corner, well, let's make sure nobody's running conduit or, you know, plumbing lines or something down in that corner, because it's not something that we would pick up on a design intent model where those framing members were at LOD 300. It would look like there's an opportunity to put something there. You know, how do we deal with bracing? You know, metal stud bracing was another huge one. If you have a hanging soffit in a space, well, somebody thinks they could be running their ductwork through there. It's all open because the architectural drawings say brace as required, and that's not something that an architect is going to model. That becomes means and methods. So this ambiguous space of what do we need to do to really leverage a multidisciplinary coordination and clash detection effort drove the need for 350 to occur in between 300 and 400. And it's good that we did that because it was a gap and it was addressed. And I think it's really been something that's helped the industry because that's a critical component as we go through the design and construction process.
Definitely. Are there any other projects you'd like to tell us about at Canon Design now? I know we've spoken a lot about your modular, but there's cool stuff going on there that I probably don't even know about yet.
You know, I think we still have the opportunity where we're working with a lot of different owners on BIM standards. You know, I think this is a really great opportunity for us to share our experiences and really help owners take advantage of a more efficient delivery process with these modules, with BIM. I think what we did at Ohio State was really worthwhile and has allowed us to be seen as leaders in the industry on being able to share how these tools and these models can bring value. And a lot of the other clients that we're working with are asking about that. We're helping them address what's needed. And, you know, that always goes back to, you know, what's in an RFP, what's in an RFQ, what information is going to be turned over, how are they going to use it? What system is it going into? So again, it's really about a process and how do you capture that entire design, you know, plan, design, construct, operate continuum for usability. I think some other projects that have been fun is for us to advance our design build efforts. I know we have a couple projects at LAC, USC project not only took advantage of our Modular Design Plus, but we were in fact the design builder and AE on that project. So it was very inclusive of all the integrated services that we can provide. And, you know, that's really something that, you know, that's where I find my interest. That's what I get excited about, being able to merge VDC and design build from a larger process improvement initiative.
Brian, I hope to maybe come out and visit sometime. I live in LA, so University of Southern California is not too far from me.
Very nice.
Can I invite myself over?
You can. I would love to get out there. Unfortunately, with COVID, I've not had the opportunity to travel out there, be able to see that, which would have been great to have a little more on-site time in our factory to see those units be constructed and then delivered and installed. So I've had to view those through photos and videos, unfortunately, but I would have loved to have been out there to see it in person.
Yeah, VR walkthroughs are becoming more popular these days because no one can travel. And, right. You know, the one time Brian and I always see each other is Autodesk University every year. So we're all hoping that in November, hey, maybe, who knows, we'll be able to travel again.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
We thank you for joining us, Brian. It's always great to talk about BIM and VDC and modular with you.
Thanks for having me.
This has been an ENR Tech Talk. I'm Jeff Yoders.
And I'm Eileen Cho. To listen to more ENR Critical Path podcasts, please visit enr.com/podcasts, or you can also like and follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Thanks for listening.